trains and boats and planes were passing by. They mean a trip to Paris or Rome to someone else, but not for me. The trains and the boats and planes took you away, away from me.
This is The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. In 6 weeks, lawmakers will convene for a special session to find a solution to the ever-increasing cost of rail. The group Save the Rail hopes to give them something to chew on between now and then. It's holding a public forum at the Capitol this week to talk about what they call Option 2A, street-level rail from Middle Street. The group has brought in an urban transit planning expert with a 54-year career as an academic and a consultant to cities around the globe. Dr. Vukan Vucic is Professor Emeritus of Systems Engineering at the University of Pennsylvania, the author of 5 books. He's also our guest today. Thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me. I am your listener and supporter in Philadelphia.
Nice to know. Thank you. As you look at this city, and you've been to Honolulu several times, this is not your first time here, and seeing how this has happened up to this point, we've been trying to create a livable city, and certainly you can see some evidence of that. But in now looking at bringing rail to grade at Middle Street, is that the best option you see?
Yes. The situation in Honolulu has been that it is naturally has conditions to be a very livable city. And one condition to have a livable city is to get to have good public transportation system, rail especially. Why rail? Because it's a linear city. It has also many tourists and other people who would prefer not to depend on the car. And if they don't depend on the car, then the city will be more livable. We have these policies and discussions in many cities, we have changed from attempts in 1950s, 60s to rebuild cities into car-based cities, which really became huge parking lots and highways and so on, very unattractive for people. Now we're saying our goal is not to get as many cars as fast as possible through the city. Our goal is to create a livable city. And livable city, if it's of a size of half a million or 1 million or 5 million, cannot be livable unless it has a good, attractive transit system.
When you talk about an attractive transit system, you're also talking about a system that people are going to be using. That's really the attractive part of it, not something that simply may be aesthetically nice or something that doesn't block us from the ocean, particularly for Honolulu. But when this idea has come up over and again with HART, with the authority, they've turned it down and they've said, well, you know, look, the problems with this include the fact that you're going to have slowing of traffic. You're not going to be able to get as many cars through. You're also going to find that these trenches that you say are going to be smaller, in fact, are going to have to be wider and deeper. Why do you say that's not true?
Well, it's not true that it'll reduce the capacity for other traffic and even some say increase congestion. No. When you build a new rail transit line, it certainly decreases congestion because it attracts people from the car much better than buses can. So the problem then is also, if you build that rail system, how will it, in what position will it be? If you build a metro system, it has to be totally separated, and therefore it has to be either elevated or in the tunnel. In recent decades, however, there have been many, many cities around the world that have developed so-called light rail transit system, and that is transit system that is capable of different roles and so on. A light rail can be at grade with certain separations and special signals and so on. It can be on separate rights of way where it's nearly independent of traffic. It can be on some sections 5 or 10 miles separated from traffic and run as fast as metro. So what you have here with the aerial structure will be fine. That's separated. But when it comes downtown, and now every time I come here, I do see that Honolulu is becoming more and more livable. I cannot imagine that through these streets you build an elevated structure which would separate more the city from the ocean and so on. There are now, in many countries which had abandoned old streetcars, they now have built new light rail transit systems. 25 cities in France have new light rail systems. We have over 20 such systems also. Cities which said we really, nobody would run, use public transportation, like in Dallas, Texas. Dallas light rail is extremely successful. They recently voted to double investment into a twice larger network of light rail lines. And those light rail lines then you use in center city to rebuild the whole city more pedestrian friendly. You have pedestrian sections and you have then light rail going slower or no other traffic and so on. Then the same line continues and goes full speed the same as metro.
So at this point, because I think you know, you're painting a picture here that a lot of people would like to see happen, to be able to have easy access to a rail, whatever it might be. But because we've been watching these costs escalate so incredibly and hit these you know these stratospheric amounts that we thought would never happen, and looking at the timeline being extended and going back and asking for more money from you know people's pocketbooks to be able to help pay for this through extended taxes or whatever else may happen, there seems to be a real sensitivity with both lawmakers and the public to what's happening with rail and what could happen with it. Do you really see that if it were to go to an at-grade system that this would be less expensive for people?
Oh, there's no discussion about that. Of course. I mean, building a track in the street, regardless that you have to still dig and build, which you would have to do for any highway or any BRT, any other mode that you have. But that, compared with an aerial structure, is many times cheaper. You use that at the same time to rebuild the cities in more pedestrian-friendly way and so on. The project that has been done so far is really in has great problem, especially financial. Now, even if the surface transit were more expensive, which is the opposite, it's much less expensive. Even if it's more expensive, I would suggest that you select the at-grade running because of the much better environmental impact on the city. It really makes city greener and more pedestrian-friendly rather than shaded and in front of historic buildings and separated from the ocean. Now, another question has come. How can you change now? And people sometimes say, you're absolutely right, but it's too late. My answer is, it is never too late to stop going in the wrong direction. And really, I will give a talk in 2 days there about light rail transit systems, showing city after city and how in recent decades the so-called noisy and old-fashioned streetcars have been replaced now by modern light rail, and how dozens of cities all around the world are using that mode and adjust it. And on the same line, as I mentioned, you can have it being very pedestrian-friendly and then separate lanes, and then it can be fully separated as you already have that structure, those structures.
So as you look at the barriers to doing that, is it really coming down to heart and their intransigence?
Yeah. I cannot understand that nobody wants to change the project when it has such fantastic financial problems and financial problems increasing and so on. You're against the wall now, and you really have to do something. And if you don't have enough money, then you look at lower at more effect, more more efficient, lower cost, and soon and faster built alternative. And I'm going to show especially the details of how light rail can be not replacing this, but really changing the part through the city where it's really most important that it is pedestrian friendly and more attractive for riders.
We'll look forward to hearing you. Thank you so much for coming in today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Vukan Vucic is Professor Emeritus of Systems Engineering at University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of 5 books and an urban transit consultant to cities including New York, Washington, and Istanbul. Last month, Dr. Vucic was awarded for the first Lifetime of Academic Distinction Award by the American Public Transportation Association. The public forum, Rail Option 2A, Street Level Rail from Middle Street, happens on Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. in the Capitol Auditorium. It's free and open to everyone.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, whose students contribute 60,000 hours of community service annually. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, virtual reality tech portrays a harsh reality. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we got to thinking about Hawaii's endangered forest birds. The one we're thinking about today is not only critically endangered, it's one of the smallest, less than 4 inches long when it's full grown. It's a species of honey creeper that's found only on Kauai. And like all honey creepers, it has a curved bill, the better to extract nectar from plants like ohia and lehua and ohelo. Males have a distinct bright yellow plumage, and females are less brightly colored with greenish-yellow feathers. Scientists estimate that it has lost 85% of its habitat over the years. Once it was found in all of Kauai's forests, but today it's only found above the 2,000-foot level, with the majority of its population found above 3,600 feet. Like so many other forest birds, it has fallen victim to habitat loss and invasive species. Today we're looking for its name. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to call us with the correct answer gets our reusable tote bag that tells everybody you got it right. Neon signs in the night, red and blue city lights, cargo trains rolling by.
Aloha, this is Will Shorts, Puzzle Master for NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Advanced computer technology is often seen as producing a kind of dispassionate detachment from life's flesh and blood realities. But this is an example of technology in the service of empathy, a project that originated at Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab that uses a virtual reality experience to simulate the everyday lives of the homeless. Students at Honolulu's Mid-Pacific Institute are the first high school students to take part and provide what Stanford calls empathy data on the project. Brian Dote, Chief Innovations Officer for Mid-Pacific Institute, is in our studio to tell us more. Thanks for coming in, Brian.
Oh, thank you for having me.
My first reaction to my response to a description of virtual reality is all about, you know, a kind of a detachment. You know, let's kill the monsters as they appear, right? This is very different. This asks you to feel something for And how does it do that?
So I think if you look at the gamut of available technologies today, mm-hmm. Virtual reality is probably the premier technology to use to gain empathy in a viewer. And the reason I say that is the virtual reality experience is one of the only experiences where you can live the life of someone, or you can be, you know, virtually in their shoes, mm-hmm. or you can experience the world from their perspective. And knowing that, if you combine that with a great story and storytelling skills, you can wrap your viewer in an experience that just oozes empathy.
What's this experience like?
So this one is a very interesting one. And again, it's in partnership with Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab. And it puts the viewer in the experience of someone that is about to become homeless and then lives in their car and then is homeless and is riding on a city bus. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it takes you through these sort of chapters, if you will. And the students experience the life of someone that's getting evicted from their apartment and having to decide on what to sell to sort of survive, and then puts them in an experience where they're living in their car. Mm-hmm. And so they're, you know, I guess de facto at that point, you're sort of homeless. And then it puts them in an experience where they're riding on a city bus, and it's a little more visceral, scary experience. And there's other people on the bus, and they're trying to protect their backpack. And as the bus is moving, your backpack is sliding around, and there's people on the bus that you're a little wary of. And I think the other reason that the virtual reality experience is so great is in an environment like that, because you are seeing a single point of view, and that's the point of view of the homeless person, mm-hmm. you can't see what's going on in your environment. And that's really cool, because as you look to the front of the bus, you're not really aware of what's happening in the back of the bus. If you look to the back of the bus, you're not really aware of what's happening in the front of the bus. Mm-hmm. And so your senses are sort of heightened, as if it would be if you were really sitting on a bus. And
sure.
So I think it's so engaging and so immersive that it's very visceral in that sense.
The thing that's interesting to me about that, Brian, is that we're not often encouraged to think of homeless people as vulnerable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We think of ourselves as vulnerable to them.
Exactly.
Not the other way around.
That's because I think for many of us, we've never had that experience, or we've never experienced being on the other side. And that's really what this VR experience is about, is putting you in the perspective, in the shoes, you know, the virtual shoes of a homeless person. And
what
so,
if you're on a bus with no place to go? Most exactly. of your valued possessions are in your backpack, and you're getting sleepy, but you're trying to protect it.
Exactly. And you're alone, and you're, yeah, like you said, the backpack is your life. Everything you own is in it. You don't know who to trust. Maybe you can't trust anyone, and you are by yourself, right?
And somebody might be sneaking up on you.
Exactly. So in this experience, I'm glad you mentioned that, because in this experience, as you're paying attention to your backpack, making sure no one steals it, one of the people in the bus actually starts to sneak up on you, and there's a moment in time where many of our students either gasp or scream or get surprised, because as they turn to look to the back of the bus, he has come up right behind you. And, you know, that's real life. That's what could happen, and probably mm-hmm. very well does happen on a city bus in that kind of environment.
It's like that gasp you get in a scary movie.
Exactly, exactly.
Don't walk down that hallway. Don't open that door.
And let me guide your eye away from the door long enough so uh-huh. that the, you know, so that the bad scary guy can sneak up behind you.
Right.
So that's very much what it's like.
And I'm assuming that the kids who took part, he had about 40 kids
yes.
take part in this. I assume they didn't have any trouble getting immersed in the experience.
No, I think the experience, although it's not photorealistic, it's immersive enough with when you combine the full 360, being able to see everywhere with audio and narration, and you know, you're wearing the goggles, and so the rest of reality is now gone,
mm-hmm.
and everything you see, hear, and sort of feel inside is what you're experiencing through the virtual reality environment. And I think kids really can dive deep into that kind of environment, because they are very used to being in a sort of a game engine, a game engine design environment like
yeah.
that.
So much of the initial sort of response of companies creating material for virtual reality has been encouraging us to, commit violent acts and be detached from the consequences of those violent acts, a desensitizing effect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that a fair description?
I think that's a fair description. And I think what we as an educational institution focus on is the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
Really taking modern high-end technology like VR and trying to tell the stories behind the characters. You know, before before you, in a game, do something to another character, maybe understanding what that character is about or the background history of that person or how that character got to be at that phase of their life in the story. And so really, although the VR industry has started with gaming and you know, violent gaming and other things, I think it's rapidly moving to becoming a very, very robust, engaging storytelling tool. Mm-hmm. Like this one, for example, you know, where you can teach empathy or gain empathy through a story that is very richly engaging. And that's actually how our immersive tech program at Mid-Pacific started, because a few years ago, this filmmaker called, his name is Chris Milk in New York, he created a Syrian refugee experience. And it was a full 360 immersive experience. Wow. Where you looked at your feet and you're in dirt. Mm-hmm. And that's her home. And you look out the window and you see everything that she sees, and you walk with her and you are living her experience. And the idea was to put this experience, and what he did was every UN ambassador, before voting on whatever that resolution was, they went through that experience.
Wow.
And now they understood, like, this is the real deal. This is what it's like to be a Syrian refugee. So now you come from a place of empathy as opposed to being detached or, you know, an outsider.
You wonder, you know, hearing about the capabilities of that technology, just looking at it afresh, you wonder what a great novelist might have done with this, what a Shakespeare might have done with that means of, you know, because that's what any artist is trying
exactly,
to do. Right?
Exactly. And the hope is with these tool sets, the next Shakespeare or the next artist is going to come through our school, use these tools and build those experiences, right? Mm-hmm. Because this is a novel way of filmmaking. It's a novel way of storytelling. You don't have a single camera and a single viewpoint. You're sort of engaging with the environment. You can look anywhere. You can touch things. You can move around. And the hope is, our goal is to let students explore these tools so that they can create the next sort of VR Shakespeare experience.
Yeah. The students were asked to respond. They
Correct.
Were surveyed. What kind of responses did they give?
So the end of the actual experience culminated in questions that the students answered. And part of it was to see if students would support a resolution or sign a petition in support of homeless initiatives. And after the experience, they all were in support of that initiative. And they all felt that the immersive experience was very realistic. They strongly agreed that it was a realistic experience. And they all left in support of a petition for supporting homeless causes.
Every single one of them?
Every single one of the 40 students.
That's a powerful lesson in
exactly.
itself, isn't it, Brian? Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Brian Doty is the Chief Innovations Officer for Mid-Pacific Institute, which is taking part in a virtual reality project that originates at Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab. You can get details on our Conversation Facebook page.
Both sides lobbied heavily. In the end, the aquarium fish collection bill got the governor's veto. Civil Beat reporter Nathan Eagle has a reality check. Hi, Nathan.
Hi.
This was a contentious bill, if ever there were one, and we talked about this a little earlier this month, and last month, too, about how much lobbying was going on both sides. What was the governor's final decision or part of his decision-making in saying that this was going to get his veto?
Well, as you mentioned, there was heavy lobbying. He indicated yesterday that it was thousands and thousands of phone calls and emails from both sides coming in right up to the last minute. But ultimately, he said that the science isn't quite there to justify stopping the issuance of new aquarium permits.
So that means that companies that do this can continue to do that if they already have a permit?
Yes, that's correct. And new permits can continue to be issued. And as some of the supporters of the measure had indicated, one of their biggest concerns is that there's no limit on those number of permits.
So in assessing the idea that there maybe should be more discussion about this, what is the governor proposing regarding what DLNR should be doing?
Well, he's saying, hey, everyone, let's all get together on this. I obviously have some concerns about it. He's got going to have the DLNR, Suzanne Case is the director over there, work as well with Bruce Anderson, who's head of the Division of Aquatic Resources, get together with some of the supporters, the critics, and say, let's come up with some rules. Maybe there's some administrative things we can do. Let's also look at what kind of legislation we might be able to put together for next session. So things like maybe capping the permit numbers, addressing catch limits, establishing permit fees, things like that.
The bottom line is, how do you define what sustainable means in this context?
Exactly. And that's a big question that I'm not sure we have an answer for yet.
Well, clearly the supporters of the bill are not happy about this. Have you talked to them at all in terms of where they go next?
I have. And you're right. They're not happy at all about it. And they're anxious and optimistic to get towards next session and try again. But at the same time, you know, it's the sting of this defeat is serious. And they're, you know, they'd never seen this bill, which they've advocated for years, make it this far. So then to have it get shot down, it hurts.
And I can't imagine that they are particularly, you know, looking forward to sitting down with everybody and trying to hash this out when they feel such animus toward it.
Right, right. And there's some that are like, okay, fine, let's just set this aside. Let's do this. Let's get together and work. Others, I think, are a little bit more, we need to cool off for a little bit.
Is there any timetable to when the various factions will gather?
I did hear from Director Case that she estimated over the next couple months or something like that, she hopes to have something put together.
Maybe after everybody has a chance to take a couple of breaths.
Yes.
All right, Nathan, we'll be watching this one. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today featuring reporter Nathan Eagle. The sand fight on Maui may be over. Mayor Alan Arakawa says he's brokered a deal with the companies which have been shipping sand to other islands, largely for the construction industry. Community activists documenting the sand mining have continued to advocate that it stop, but according to the mayor, they're not the only ones. We talked yesterday about a 10-year-old study that warned the availability of sand would quickly diminish. So, what happened? Well, according to Mayor Arakawa,
when we did the study, probably 2 years before the study was published, we were very concerned about the diminishing sand volumes that we had within the county already. And the study basically showed that we had one stockpile of sand left in central Maui, and almost all of the rest had been depleted. So that was the red flag that came up. And we went to our county council and asked them to pass a rule that would ban the exporting of sand from Maui. And they were unable to do so.
What happened? Why were they unable to?
State law allowed interstate commerce, so they were able to haul sand between the islands. And they're still allowed to do so. So for the county to try and ban it was deemed inappropriate from a legal standpoint, which is why the council never did. Now, the council, we put down another warning to the council asking them again to look into it again because we're still depleting our sand resources. And there were literally barge loads after barge loads leaving our island. What we've done in the meantime is I've contacted the company, HCND, who is hauling the sand to Oahu, and they've agreed to stop hauling sand off island. The project that they're taking the sand from, which is Maui Lani, has also agreed not to ship sand off island. So with the last of the areas that we can mine sand out of, which is where this project is, both companies have now agreed not to ship off island, even though legally they're entitled to do so.
Given the fact that the mechanism for them to do that is perfectly legal, but now because of your intervention, maybe what we're seeing come out of the community and a lot of pressure and people documenting sand leaving, it seems like that's been the driver for their decision, is it?
To some degree, yes. But, you know, we've been pushing this for some time now and getting the agreement from them because they also have projects on Maui that they have to work with. This does not stop them from being able to use sand on Maui. Now, the big selling point was that when we have projects on Maui, if we have depleted our sand resource, then we're going to have to go to Australia or some other country and buy the sand and be able to import it into our community. And it makes no sense to have to import sand when we already have a reserve here. Now, that's the economics of it. So every project that would be here on in our community would have to pay that much more to be able to haul the sand from some other shore into our county.
Mr. Mayor, you mentioned that's the economics of it, but what about the cultural and environmental aspects to sand mining? That wouldn't seem to take care of that part if they're still able to use it for projects on Maui because they're still using the same sand.
Well, the cultural and environmental issues have never been raised before to be litigated. Now, we do have a cultural advisor on site, and we do have the ability within our state laws to be able to do this, which is why getting the companies to agree voluntarily to do their own ban was the only way that we could see of stopping it without trying to change the state law, which would probably happen much later than we would want.
What's in the company's interest to do all this, aside from the fact that you've talked to them? Clearly they're seeing public pressure, but where does this leave them for what they will continue to need to do?
Well, again, talking to them and making them realize that using the product within our community and being able to try and satisfy the community is a greater good than any profit that's being made by shipping the sand off island.
Right, that's for the sand that's going away, but if you're just talking about sand use totally, whether it's sand use on Maui or putting it on a barge and sending it someplace else, there are those in the community who are saying, well, wait a minute, this might be disturbing remains that might be there or that there might be some other reason environmentally not to be sand mining.
From the cultural aspect, there's been a cultural advisor on site for all the sand mining. Leslie Kulaloyo was the cultural advisor that they had hired. He's been there. So the companies, HC&D and Mawilani, have been paying for this cultural advisor. So they've been doing it technically having the advice of a cultural advisor. So they weren't violating any of the cultural aspects of it. Wherever they found burials, they were taking the appropriate action to be able to care for it. Now, as far as environmental, this has never been an environmental issue because removing the sand, the surface sand, was not destroying an environment. This is a stockpile. Now, this is something that has never been brought forth before. Now, even within Oahu, when they were moving sand around, you're replenishing Waikiki Beach with Maui sand. You're pretty much building your train tracks with Maui sand. What is the environmental impact to have to be able to bring in sand to be able to do this? You know, they should never, the environmental concerns should never deplete a community's assets just to be able to satisfy some other community.
I noticed in your column that you said that it's important to protect our island sand resources for cultural, environmental, and economic reasons. And, of course, you're talking about Maui. Also, the fact that, you know, sand isn't sand. Sand that you can use for creating concrete isn't necessarily going to be the same sand that you're going to find appropriate to put on a beach. We have been told that the sand that was coming here from Maui was being used for construction, but certainly not to be replenishing any beaches.
I think you better check your research. My understanding is it was also used to replenish Waikiki Beach. So you're correct. There are different qualities of sand. And the sand that's come off of Maui County, it's not necessarily the same place now. Remember, you've depleted the sand from many other areas, including some of our beaches. So some of the beach sand that was formerly shipped to Oahu may very well have come from Maui, and I'm almost positive that it's come from Maui. I know that they were also taking sand from Molokai and exporting it to Oahu. So this is something that we drew attention to before we did the study and was one of the premier reasons why we initiated the study. We're looking at depleting sand from Maui County in its entirety, not just one deposit area.
For the community that's still very riled up about all of this, for whatever reasons, What have you been doing to speak with them and to hear what they have to say, even if it turns out to be something that is either, you know, rightly placed or wrongly placed with the companies and with the county?
Well, again, we're taking an action to voluntarily have it prohibited from being exported. So we're stopping the sand mining, essentially, which is what the community is asking for. We're doing it in the mechanism that's allowable to us by law. So we're getting what the community wanted accomplished, whether it be for environmental reasons or whether it be for cultural reasons or business reasons. We are literally stopping the operation by getting voluntary cooperation. Going through a legislative process and trying to change the laws and trying to go through court battles would take much, much longer. So in order to satisfy the communities concerned, we've taken the direct route, and we're stopping the export of sand because we were able to work with the companies to get it done voluntarily. Now, as the legislative bodies and the state legislature want to be able to explore cultural remedies or environmental remedies, that's fine. They're welcome to go ahead and look at the long-term solutions. But in the meantime, we wanted to make sure that we weren't losing more sand off of our community. So we've taken these steps.
Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for the time today.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bethann.
Alan Arakawa is the mayor of Maui County. He recently wrote a column about exporting of Maui sand. It's on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
This week in This American Life. Okay, why exactly is anybody surprised North Korea is launching ICBMs?
They've done 4 nuclear tests. 3 times they have paraded road mobile ICBMs. They put up a map of the United States with targets on it that said mainland strike plan. And people are like, what do you think they're saying?
Saying no to reality this week.
Hear This American Life, Saturday at 1 p.m.
Aloha, this is Sonia Patel. You're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about one of the birds whose survival is a primary concern of the Kauai Forest Bird Recovery Project. It's a small honey creeper that's found only on the Garden Isle's upland forests. Males have a bright yellow plumage. Females are greenish yellow. The birds are protected and are most likely to be seen in the Alakai Wilderness Preserve, Waimea Canyon, or Kokei State Park. Mosquitoes have severely hurt the species, as have habitat loss, climate change, introduced invasive plants, and predators like rats and cats. If you're on Kauai's upland, first listen for its call, a pair of notes, tu-wheat, or its song, a trill of we see, we see, we see. Its Latin name is Maguma parva, but local folks know it as the ani-ani-ao. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, welcoming students, parents, teachers, and administrators back to school. Learn more about new product and training updates for Hawaii schools at Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Scientists from the NOAA Fisheries Pacific Islands region have just set out on an ambitious 6-month project. a survey of whale, dolphin, and seabird populations around the Hawaiian archipelago, a 1.8 million square mile area. Dr. Erin Olson is the co-chief scientist for the expedition, and she spoke with us yesterday from the deck of her ship just off the Kona coast.
We are out right now on the Hawaiian Islands Cetacean and Ecosystem Assessment Survey. We call it HISES. And the goal of our mission is to survey for the abundance and also the population structure and population health of all of the different species of cetaceans in the Hawaiian archipelago. So we'll be surveying from shore out to 200 miles offshore, the entire distance of the Hawaiian archipelago from 200 miles south of the Big Island to 200 miles north of Kure Atoll. And while we're out here, we also have seabird observers, and we're doing various ecosystem measurements so that we can get a complete picture of not only cetacean habitat, but also just general oceanographic conditions and ecosystem health. The survey is really designed to provide the data that's needed for Marine Mammal Protection Act and Endangered Species Act species assessment. So how are the individual populations doing? Are they increasing, decreasing, or just stable? And can we identify what the population units are? Some of the populations around Hawaii are actually very small and isolated, you know, around just an individual island, or they could be quite broadly distributed throughout the entire archipelago.
What do you hope to find? You know, what would be your druthers and a really good positive result?
So our number one great outcome would be that we have a lot of encounters with several different species. We have 25 species of cetaceans in Hawaii. So we'd like to have enough encounters with all of those species to be able to estimate their population abundance. That's really the overall driver of a huge effort like this. But in addition to that, we hope to be getting genetic samples and aerial photography and acoustic recordings of all of these different species that are then going to help us answer other questions about population structure and contaminants and what they're foraging on and how they communicate, all those kinds of biological questions that are important to put the context of what the population size is.
What's your definition of population structure? I'm not sure I understand that.
Sure. So population structure would be, for example, we know that there are spinner dolphins distributed throughout the Hawaiian archipelago, but not all of those spinner dolphins are related to each other. They're all the same species, but they form sort of individual populations around each individual island, and those populations are genetically distinct from each other. They don't interbreed, and they primarily stick around their sort of home core range. So we would call that, you know, a very fine-scale population structure for species like spinner dolphins, where there's 7 or 8 different populations throughout the archipelago.
And that's, so overall, you're accumulating an awful lot of information, aren't you?
We are. We have a visual team collecting visual sighting data on all of the different groups that we see throughout the day, but we're also recording passive acoustic data. So we tow a hydrophone array behind the ship, and it helps us to find animals. They're commonly using sound when they're navigating and foraging, and so we're sort of eavesdropping in on that, and we can use that to help us locate animals. And that is a huge data stream we're accumulating. By the end of the survey, probably about 100 terabytes of acoustic data. And then on top of that, we have aerial imagery and photographs and biopsy samples and all sorts of other ecosystem data. It's a fairly sizable data effort, data collection effort, and just manpower effort.
Sounds like it. Hydrophone being an underwater microphone? You're recording the sounds of cetaceans.
That's right. It essentially is an underwater microphone, and we put them in a string of several of them together. So there are 4 or 5 of these underwater microphones all in a line. And based on when we hear the sound on the different hydrophone elements, we can tell where the sound is coming from, and that helps us track them down.
You can estimate distance by things like the volume of the sound.
Volume definitely helps. We can also get distance basically just by if we continue to move forward. So we'll hear a sound, and the acousticians can use the difference in the time that the sound arrives at the different hydrophones to get a bearing angle to the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we move forward, they get another bearing angle, and eventually we get a couple of sounds. Those bearing angles will cross, and that tells us where the group is. So then we can measure that distance from our current location, and if it's close enough and worth the time, we turn and can go get additional information from that group.
You go to try and get a look at them.
That's right. We want to know primarily what species they are. For a lot of species, we can actually tell based on the acoustic signatures or the sounds that the animals are making what species it is. But for a lot of dolphin species, they actually sound fairly similar to each other, and so it is important then for us to turn so we can get closer and the visual team can then see the group and tell us what species it is. And that really adds a lot to the data stream in terms of utility of the acoustic data for estimating other parameters like foraging rate or population size.
Did you say foraging rates?
Yeah, so particularly dolphins and other species like beak whales and sperm whales, they use echolocation clicks to echolocate off and find things that they want to eat. So they produce a sound that echoes off of the fish or the copepod or whatever thing they're trying to find, and that tells them how far away it is. So by us listening in on their echolocation, we can understand are they foraging at that time, or if they're not producing echolocation clicks, maybe they're just whistling, then they're probably socializing. And so we can kind of get a sense of how will they spend their day. Are we hearing a lot of echolocation during the day, or do we mainly hear it at night? And that's different for every species.
It sounds as if, from things I've read anyway, some of the things that cetaceans do are more or less just for fun. Is that accurate?
That's true, yeah. Or at least that's our interpretation. It looks like they're having fun.
It sure does.
They're pretty intelligent species, and so they probably are enjoying themselves when spinner dolphins jump out of the water and are spinning around. Some people would say that's to get rid of some parasite or remora on their bodies, but oftentimes we think they're probably just doing it for fun.
Well, let's hope so. Something about that is a very appealing notion, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I love being in the water. It seems like it would be amazing to be able to have that sort of ability to really play around like that, sort of envy them sometimes.
Oh, I would think so. You know, Dr. Olson, I know this is the beginning of a 187-day mission, so we'd really like to talk to you at the end and see what you've found, because I suspect there are going to be you're going to be gathering some information that hasn't gathered before. Don't you think that's a possibility?
Absolutely. We're actually gathering new information right now as we speak. We have a team out flying a drone, a hexacopter, over a group of pilot whales collecting aerial imagery, and that's the kind of new, interesting, and exciting stuff that we're hoping to do throughout the 187 days, is a lot of opportunity to get a lot of new technology and new information that we haven't been able to do on prior surveys like this.
Dr. Aaron Olson is the co-chief scientist for the NOAA Fisheries Pacific Island Region 6-month survey to survey whales, dolphins, and seabirds around the Hawaiian archipelago. You can learn more about the expedition on our Facebook page, The Conversation. There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, more than any one person can keep track of. But Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Hi, Derek.
Hello. Hello, Chris. How are you?
I remember when I was a kid, we had Shakespeare in the Park in my hometown, and they've got it in Hilo.
Yeah, in Hilo, the Shakespeare in the Park, it's an annual thing there, mm-hmm. and the Hilo community players this year present the best of the Bard 2 in Kalakaua Park in Hilo. They describe it as a patchwork quilt of selections of some of Shakespeare's most beloved scenes, sonnets, and soliloquies. And this production explores friendship and loyalty. Those are the themes within the Bard's works. Shakespeare in the Park begins tomorrow at 7:30 in Kalakaua Park in Hilo and runs on weekends through July 29th.
That's kind of an interesting idea, isn't it? Sort of Shakespeare's greatest hits.
Right, right.
And there's a workshop in Waimanalo tomorrow on potted plants.
Yes, I have learned that potted plants can clean the air, help heal wounds, and brighten our moods. Noitanigawa often brings plants here into the nation.
They brighten our moods?
Yes, definitely brighten our moods. Now, this workshop discusses using air-purifying plants for certain areas and how to enhance your living space with plant arrangements. It's tomorrow at 2 at Geobunga Waimanalo. And this is free, but you do need tickets at the link on our website.
Geobunga, huh?
Correct.
It's a new one on me. I always learn new things.
Yes.
And you can find out who the rising stars of Kauai are tomorrow night.
The Hawaii Children's Theater presents its Rising Stars Gala Showcase and Fundraiser tomorrow. This will be in the Kauai War Memorial Convention Hall. Doors open at 5. The show starts at 7. You can buy dinner, and there's a silent auction as well. All proceeds go to Hawaii Children's Theater. For ticket information, please go to our website.
Fair enough. Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Balama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. But you can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
That's going to do it for us today. Now, coming up tomorrow, Governor Ige joins us for Town Square.
And if you missed any of this show or want to hear a past show, you can find all of them on the Conversation page, along with links to information about guests and topics covered on the show. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org.
And if you want us to know something about what you're thinking of what you hear on the show, you can always call our talkback line and leave us your comments. The number is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, post comments on Facebook at The Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. Or if you'd like, you can get to me at BKOZHPR.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Join me tomorrow for Town Square.